Our speaker this afternoon is eminently qualified to discuss classical liberalism with us. When Ralph Rako was a college student at the University of Chicago, he studied under F.A. Hayek, probably the most important representative of the classical liberal tradition in the United States in the post-war period.
Okay, thank you.
Before that, as a high school student in New York, he had attended the Mises seminars with Ludwig von Mises. And of course, as an elementary school student, he had been a friend of Cobden and Bright in his younger days. He is currently a research scholar in residence at the Institute for Humane Studies at George Mason University. He teaches history at SUNY College in Buffalo. He has been a senior editor of Inquiry and was editor of the New Individualist Review, the magazine that Roy Child said was the only libertarian magazine better than Libertarian Review. And he has written widely for a variety of magazines. Ralph?
You know, this is not the, of course, the first year that we've done this. And it turns out that, don't be misled, David Bowie's one joke is about that I studied in elementary school with Cobden and Bright. So don't expect any more from him, certainly, for this conference. And I wouldn't be surprised if there were no new jokes from him for the rest of his life. You're going to be finding that there'll be a good deal of lecturing on historical topics at this week. I'm going to be discussing history, of course. George Smith will largely be discussing history. Leonard Liggio, Ted Carpenter, to a great extent. And it will come into other people's lectures as well. I hope this doesn't distress you. I don't know what your previous experience with history courses has been. With too many people, unfortunately, it's the same way the public schools have destroyed Shakespeare or, God, George Eliot. I mean, I can't imagine myself sitting down and reading something by George Eliot after we were forced to go through Middlemarch in public school. And it's an interesting thing to consider what the next generation is going to be like in regard to sex after sex education in the public schools. But one thing, that'll clear up many of the problems that the moral majority is worried about. But one thing that they certainly have done a great job with is history. And I think it's typical of many people's reaction to history. The response of the Harvard freshman who was asked by his professor, what is history? And his answer was, history is one damn thing after the other. Now, that's one very common view, but that's not my view. It's not the view, certainly, of some of the great classical liberal historians themselves of the 19th century, like Lord Acton or Tocqueville, who saw history really as something quite different, as the struggle, the never-ending struggle, for the individual, for her rights as against power. This struggle takes different forms at different stages of history, but if we see this as the thread that runs through history, it makes it into quite a story. Quite a story. You know who you could get a sense of this from, who deals with history in this way also, and this may seem like an odd person to mention in this connection, but the great libertarian psychiatrist, Thomas Sowers, if you read a book of his, such as The Manufacture of Madness, which is largely a historical work about the treatment of witches and then the historical treatment of the so-called mentally ill. And there you see that history can really be presented as a rather stirring story of the struggle for self-respect, for dignity, for rights. And if we view history in this way, what strikes us are the great changes that have occurred. You and I, of course, have been born into a world that was shaped by classical liberalism. I was born into an early phase of this world, David wanted to suggest, but others into later phases, but nonetheless in a common world. It's very hard for us to imagine anything before this world. But in order to suggest to you what things were like before classical liberalism came onto the scene, and that would be at the end of the 18th century in an important practical way, beginning to change things. Let me mention to you a few items. Now, there's a very interesting school that's very famous now, a very popular school of historiography, not particularly classical liberal, called the Annales School. The leader of this, the current leader, Braudel, just died a couple of months ago. And the interesting thing about this school is that they try to go beyond the great surface events in politics, in law, in terms of empire building, down to the fabric of the lives of average people. So much of what we know about the life of most people, or the great majority of people, before the age of classical liberalism is due to the exploratory work of this school. To take a number of instances, not that these are particularly going to come from the works of Braudel, but many more similar items could be dug up. These are just going to be indicative. There was an English historian of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. His name was Edward Gibbon, and he was born in 1732 into a middle-class family in London. And he notes in his autobiography that several of the boys in his family, that is, of his brothers, were named Edward, as he was. And what was the reason for this? Had the family lost track, or crazy Edward, whatever, fetish of some kind, whatever that could be? No, as he says in his autobiography, no. It was because, of course, in the natural course of things, most of them would die, and the parents wanted one kid to be named after the father and that name to survive in the family. He said, it may seem unnatural, but it is in fact the most natural thing in the world that children should die before their parents. And that was in England, and that was a middle-class family. Here's a totally different thing. At the University of Salamanca, which was one of the great universities of Europe, Murray Rothbard, in his new History of Economic Thought, believes that the economic doctrines and truths learned at the University of Salamanca by some of the Jesuits were not surpassed until perhaps Turgot or maybe even the Austrians. A place of great brilliance. But into the 19th century, it was prohibited there to teach the doctrine that the blood circulates in the human body, because that's a terrible heresy. In Paris in 1748, two men were burned at the stake for the infamous and abominable crime of consensual sodomy. In the 18th century, in the cities of Central Europe, in Frankfurt and Koblenz and Mainz and Vienna, every night the Jews were returned to their ghetto. That's where the word ghetto comes from, their prescribed place of residence, as they had been forced to return to these areas for centuries. And this was dug out by Braudel. In the winter of 1695, not only were the peasants of France starving in their hovels, it was a very bitter winter, but the king of France, Louis XIV, the most powerful monarch in Europe, happened to look down He was at table, happened to look down, and saw that his wine had frozen in the glass. So cold was it at the Palace of Versailles. Even the most powerful monarch in Europe couldn't keep his house warm. A world that's very hard for us to understand. If you try to imagine a world consistent with these facts that I've just given you, it's a very strange one to us, and it's hard for us to think of it as being our world, but in fact, indeed, it was. I'm not talking about exotic places. I'm talking about the center and the centers and the heart of Europe itself. Now, this eventually changed, and much of what I'm going to be saying this afternoon and then this evening will be the story of how that change came about. A topic that is of interest to historians in this regard, a question that arises is this. How is it that of all the great civilizations, only our civilization has produced classical liberalism? There are other civilizations in many respects as great as that of the West, the civilization of China, of the Indian subcontinent, of Islam, and so on. But it's only in the West that classical liberalism came about and that the world was changed. This old world was changed into something that's new. And in fact, the foundations laid for the whole modern world, wherever you are in the world. We'll talk about that too. There'll be interesting changes, perhaps, that some of you will live to see in the Soviet Union. Very interesting changes. But how did it come about that this grew up in the West? And to start at the beginning of our story, we have to go way back. We have to go back to the foundations of our civilization in ancient Palestine and in ancient Greece. In ancient Palestine, there arose a people condemned by by those who came in touch with it. Would be interesting to see what a Phoenician or a Roman or an Egyptian of centuries ago would say if he knew that of all those cultures and people of the time, there's only one that would continue to exist, only one that would survive. And what distinguished this people was its peculiar religious ideas. According to the view of this people, God was a being who was unique and totally above the human race and totally above his creation. We don't have the situation that we had in most great civilizations of the past. The emperor, up until 1945, the Japanese thought that the emperor of Japan was directly descended from the goddess of the sun. The Egyptians thought that the pharaoh was one of the living gods of Egypt. But here we have a people that says, no, God is God. No one else is God. And God has laid down a law, and everybody may be judged according to this law. Not only the highest person in the land, but then, as you have in Isaiah and Jeremiah, the Hebrew people themselves can be judged according to this law and found wanting. So that you don't have the situation that existed in every other civilization of a priesthood telling the one who's at the head of the government is also a god, is not only at the head of the government, but also has the power of a divinity. No? Here, the head of the king, whoever he might be, and as I say, the Jewish people themselves, can be held to account by a higher standard and by the higher law. A similar concept was beginning to develop in ancient Greece. This takes a number of different forms. This is expressed in a number of different ways. There's a famous play by Sophocles called Antigone. I don't know if anybody's ever read that play. Anybody happen to have read that play? Okay, Antigone is the daughter of Oedipus. And in this play, her brother has attempted to overthrow the city. And the king, Creon, The brother is killed in the course of this, and Creon says, well, since he was a traitor, he shall not have the traditional burial rites. Let his body rot outside of the city walls. Let him be eaten by vermin, by dogs, and so on, because he was a filthy traitor. And Antigone can't stand this idea and goes one night and buries her brother. And Creon finds out about this. And Creon finds out that Antigone was responsible. I mean, you know, she's a Greek tragic heroine. This is not some heroine, let's say Randian heroine. She has flaws. She has a very serious flaw. It might be that her flaw is that she's very ready to be a martyr. She wants to be a martyr. Nonetheless, she's presented before the king. And he says, how could you do something like this? I ordered it. I ordered you not to. I ordered anybody. Made a law. No one was to bury Polynices. And she said, and then she answers in the great chorus, in the great section of the play, there is a law that Zeus wrote in the stars before the world was made that is a higher law than the law of the king. The law of what is owed to one's blood relation at a time like this, so that his spirit may be at peace, that's more important than a government's law. This idea of the higher law, this idea of the natural law or the law of nature took different names at different times, but it was a central concept of Western civilization and it never disappeared. It never disappeared. The idea that the earthly authority, and at times the earthly authority was really getting closer and closer to actually being worshipped as a god. Louis XIV, for instance, liked to have himself, liked to have operas written about him, where he would appear in the form of Apollo, the sun god. And now that's getting very close to the edge. But nobody ever was able to go beyond that so long as, until let's say the 20th century. But through the great span of European civilization, limits were set to the power, at least theoretically, of the king, of the ruler. And these limits were, this idea of the higher law was developed in Greece and then later in Rome by the Stoic philosophers. The ruler may not do anything he wants, even if the ruler is the people. They might not do anything they want. They can only do what is just, and what is just is determined by this law of nature. One philosopher after the other, and the most, not the greatest philosopher, but the most influential of them all, was a Roman lawyer named Cicero, who happened to be the greatest writer of prose in the Latin language. So that these ideas of the higher law and the law of nature and justice as setting a limit to what the government may do, written in his books, were read, because there was such brilliant and wonderful and glittering Latin prose by generation after generation generation after generation of students, of the elite in Europe. Now, meanwhile, back in Palestine, they had appeared on the scene, another in the line of the great teachers, a great Jewish rabbi, whom his followers thought was much, much more than that. And Acton says, do people know whom I mean when I say Lord Acton? How many people have ever heard of Lord Acton? Ah, you see, very excellent selection process this year. last year, the last time we had this, most people thought that Lord Acton, they thought Acton was a minor character in Atlas Shrugged, had something to do with the hamburger business that. And if you've heard of his name, you've certainly heard. More people have heard of what he said than of his name, because he was the one that came to the conclusion after studying history that power tends to corrupt and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Now, Acton says, a very significant point occurred during the life of Jesus. There's one time when the Pharisees are trying to get him, and they try to get him in trouble with the authorities, and they say, should we pay our taxes? All right, what does he do? You remember? Yeah, right. Show business, ask for a coin. Give me a coin. Anybody got a coin here? And whose face is on this? The face of Caesar. Render unto Caesar, therefore, what is Caesar's, and unto God what is God's. And Acton says, in this way, dividing up the realms of God and of Caesar, Caesar could not control everything. Not all life was now at the disposal of the state. There was some part of it that was outside of the state's purview. And as Acton says, the greatest or the most powerful institution in the world was created to make sure that some part did remain outside of the state's power. Because this was not simply an empty statement, a kind of bit of wishful thinking. What happened historically next was of the greatest importance. What happened historically was that in the West, in Western Europe, an ecclesiastical institution came into existence, which made it its business to see that the state didn't go as far as it wanted to. Now, see, what happened in the East was different. The Greek church fell under the total control of the state. And the Russian, when the time came after the Russians were Christianized, the Russian Orthodox Church, even more, was simply some bureau, an agency of the Tsarist government. In the West, it was different. And let me give you an instance of this. And very early on, it was different. This occurred, you know, the early part of the 4th century, Christianity is legalized under Constantine, and very soon after that, it's made the only official religion. And so the alliance, this sinister alliance between church and state, comes into existence. And as I say, in the Eastern Church, it has consequences such that liberalism doesn't arise there. There's no more chance of liberalism coming up, originating in Russia or in Byzantium than there was of it originating in India or China. It just doesn't happen. But this is what happened now by the end of the century. Bishop Ambrose of Milan, one of the Latin fathers, the man who converted St. Augustine to Christianity, had a fight with the emperor. The emperor was off in Constantinople, and Ambrose was in Milan. The emperor, Theodosius, ordered Ambrose to hand over his cathedral church in Milan to the emperor for imperial purposes. And this was Ambrose's response. At length came the command, deliver up the basilica. I reply, it is not lawful for us to deliver it up, nor for your majesty to receive it. By no law can you violate the house of a private man. And do you think that the house of God may be taken away? Notice, because it belongs to the church, it's the house of God. This gives them the self-confidence. This gives them the the forcefulness to stand up to the most powerful authority in the world, the emperor. It is asserted that all things are lawful to the emperor, but that all things are his. But do not burden your conscience with the thought that you have any right as emperor over sacred things. Exalt not yourself, but if you would reign the longer, be subject to God. It is written, God's to God and Caesar's to Caesar. Okay? Now, for 1,000 years after that, this, in a way, was the history of the West. Unlike other parts of the world, here you had two powerful institutions confronting each other, colliding, both of them wanting to be all-powerful. It's not that the church... It's not that the church... this is very dangerous. Was some institution that was dedicated heart and soul to individual right. No, it was a battle of two powers, each one of which wanted to rule totally over the population. But neither of them could succeed in totally demolishing the other. So what happens slowly over time is that some breathing space is created for people. They're not totally controlled by one power, they're not totally controlled by the other. They play each power against one off against each other. And no power can be totally deified in the public mind, because these struggles come up. And the Pope says, you know what the emperor is? The emperor is a wolf of hell. He's a limb of Satan. He's a stench in the nostrils of God. And the emperor says, you know what this man who calls himself the Pope is? He's the anti-Pope. He's the Antichrist. He's the whore of Babylon. And this kind of delegitimizing of the two great powers that occurs nowhere else in the world, because they are struggling against each other rather than mutually supporting each other the way the state and church do in all other parts of the world. And as Acton says, from this struggle that lasted for centuries, you get the Magna Carta, you get the various parliamentary representations, not just in England, but everywhere. All the countries have a representation of one. Spain is older. Spain has one that's older than the Parliament of England, the Cortes. Towns of Europe get their special privileges and their charters that guarantee them rights against the feudal lord, against the king, and so on. So you begin to have a concept of freedom in the West that emerges nowhere else to the extent that we find it. And you begin to have a whole class of people after a while. In some countries more advanced than in others, but a whole class of people who begin to think of their freedom as important. And this is reflected also in the ideology, in the scholastic philosophy at the time. With the scholastic philosophers, well, take Thomas Aquinas, for instance, as the most famous example, talking about the limitations to the power of the prince. The prince is not all-powerful. The prince is there to do to work for the common good and to work for the public good, to do justice and to avoid injustice. And the Catholic Church develops a theory whereby monarchs who become tyrants may be legitimately deposed, and eventually come to the conclusion that they may even be killed, tyrannicide. Okay? The sort of concept, imagine tyrannus, killing somebody that is considered a tyrant, the sort of concept that would have been impossible virtually anywhere else in the world, because of this, of the sacred, the divine character of the ruler of the state. So by the time we come to the modern age, to the early modern age, there's already, in theory and to a certain degree in practice, the beginnings, certainly the idea of a higher law, and there's the beginnings of the idea of individual rights as well. Certainly the idea of the limitation on the power of the state. Now, in the modern period, conventionally the modern period begins with the Renaissance and the Reformation. The Renaissance is perhaps overrated, anyway, in my opinion, in connection with the rise of classical liberalism. You know, the idea is that there's this Promethean spirit of man can do anything, man is the master of his fate, and so on, that comes up in the Renaissance, and that's somehow very useful for the idea of individual rights. Well, not really. The old institutions and the chartered rights of the Middle Ages really were much more useful for real individual rights. And this Promethean ideal, which is, you know, very compatible with one person being expressing his great individuality as a dictator by suppressing everybody else's rights. As a matter of fact, one might say that the contribution of the Renaissance was really more in a different direction, where maybe you wouldn't expect it, with the political philosopher Machiavelli. Niccolo Machiavelli, the Florentine, who wrote The Prince, of course. His name became an adjective, Machiavellian. That happens really to very few people. I only know of one, but he's not here. It's a rare occurrence that your name becomes a commonly used adjective. And what could Machiavelli have contributed to classical liberalism? Well, I think this. It's really, I would say, the essential contribution of Italian political thought. You know, there's the famous passage in The Prince where he says, people have thought of ideal republics and the idea of justice in politics. I'm writing for those who want to know the truth. I'm writing for... Look, if you want to be a kid for the rest of your life, you know, if you want to fool yourself by fantasies about politics, well, that's the way everybody, that's the way 99% of the people are. If you're part of the small percentage that wants to know the truth about politics, I'm writing for you. Politics is about power, how to keep it, how to increase it, how to maintain it. And when the politicians talk about justice, that's also a gambit to increase their power. Do you understand? That very rhetoric of justice is simply a way to increase their power, because that's all there is in politics. Okay, that's the truth. Now, if you want to go back to your dreams, your fantasies, you're welcome to them. And in a way, if you follow the course of Italian political thought, Pareto and Mosca, even to Mussolini, there's this skepticism, you might say this cynicism about politics, that's really very refreshing. It does away with a lot of the cant, a lot of the moralistic rhetoric that politicians usually indulge in. But with the Reformation, we have a movement that in the end was much more conducive to the rise of classical liberalism. Not that the Protestant reformers were liberals. You know that. John Calvin in Geneva had Servetus burned at the stake because he was a Unitarian. At the same time, ironically, of course, right? At the same time that the Inquisition was burning Calvinists, Calvin was burning some Protestant who had a different view from his own. So not that they themselves were reformers. But by breaking the monopoly of the Catholic Church, they started a trend which never ended, and that is a proliferation of small Protestant sects. And some of those sects were among the most important nurseries and hotbeds of classical liberalism in its early days. The Quakers, the Baptists, some sects of the Presbyterians. You know, the process just goes on and on. In America, they're founding new religions all the time. Americans even found religions that were headed by women, by people from Palmyra, New York, by all sorts of different kinds of religions. But you see, what that does is break up this monopoly and make impossible the idea that in any given community, you can only have one religious belief. It's hard for us to imagine why people ever thought that, but that was universally believed. If people start having any belief they want, well, this is the reason Thomas More, for instance, couldn't go along with the Reformation. In fact, you know, he became a saint of the church and so on, himself became a martyr, but he burned Protestants when Henry VIII was still a Catholic, because once you allow any new religion in, there is no end to it. It is an endless proliferation. And society will simply fragment. It will fall to pieces. Don't you understand? You have to have a supreme authority with that gives the religious tone to society and the set of moral beliefs. But Protestantism made that impossible. And Protestantism forced people to learn the lesson that no, it's not necessary for there to be a single religious and moral authority in society, over society. No, society actually can take care of that real fine on its own. In religion, for the first time, and this is why freedom of religion and freedom of religious belief is so important, for the first time the principle was established, society can run itself. Okay, in this great area of life, yeah, we can now allow the people there to come to their own conclusion on religion, and it all works out real fine. You see, the previous idea was that it had to be decided from the top down, and if it weren't, chaos, anarchy, in the bad sense of the word. This is probably one of the few places where I have to mention that it's the bad sense of the word, anarchy. So that this was the ultimate meaning of the Protestant Reformation. Through religious conflict, through oceans of blood. Sometimes people want to have us forget that, how vicious the struggle was. But the time came when the Spanish Duke of Alva put all of Holland under the judgment and verdict of death. And of course, what the English did to the Irish for mainly religious reasons was the first attempted modern genocide. So people forget that that religion was able to, religious intolerance was able to push people to this extent. I mean, it's people are so crazy sometimes. My last lecture, I guess, this evening, I haven't decided yet, but I think is going to end on an optimistic rather than a pessimistic note. But sometimes when you think about it, I mean, how people could have been so crazy as to think that, yeah, this is, of course, the obvious conclusion of the gospel of Jesus Christ is that you should go out and exterminate all the Irish, right? I mean, that's obvious. That's clear enough. It's just that he didn't have a chance to express it in so many words, but, you know, but the implication is there, huh? I mean, how people could have come to a conclusion like that? Anyway, okay, but now, you see, from another point of view, the Protestant Reformation was not very helpful to freedom. By weakening the church, that is, by splitting up religion, now the church needed the state more than the state needed the church. And the state could come, and in many cases, of course, the state took over the church. The state became, the church became the state-established religion, like in England and Scandinavia, in Prussia, and so on. So that the early modern period is the period of increasing royal absolutism. As against the late Middle Ages, the central power grows. The king sets up his own bureaucracy, mainly from the middle class, from new sources of taxes. They're supported, and they're his men. They're not feudal people who have other things to do in life and have other sources of support. This bureaucrat is the king's man, and he's the king's agent, the king's tool. Armies now are standing armies, paid. They're not feudal levies as they used to be. So the king is getting more and more power, and his claims are increasing proportionally. The great example of this is Louis XIV in France. Okay, he's not to be called King Louis, as my students try to get away with. Answers to questions, which king of France, such and such, or King Louis? This is King Louis XIV. In every aspect of life, he called himself the Sun King because he was the center of the world that was France. French society really had no moving power, no power of motion independent of him. He set things into motion in every area of life. In religion, he banned the Protestants and also tried to take power away from the Pope. He wanted to be the head of the Catholic Church in France. In politics, never called together the Estates General, created Versailles to attract the noblemen to the aristocracy to a life of idleness and gossip and affairs rather than politics. In the arts, it's an interesting fact that the greatest subsidizers, public subsidizers of art in history, have been those with the greatest political claims. The papacy in the Middle Ages and the early modern time, Louis XIV, his name stands for patron of the arts virtually. In the 20th century, the fascist dictators, they weren't very big on innovation, but enormous programs in every respect, in architecture, in painting, in drama, tremendous subsidies. Hitler and the fascists in Italy. And there's a reason. The state likes to associate this magical thing that is art with it. It lends an aura to the state. The state already has tremendous mystique to begin with, but this magic of art emphasizes that, enhances that, so that the age of Louis XIV is an age of great temporary artistic brilliance. Most of all, in economics, the state was to be the motivating center and power in society. And this was the system of mercantilism. Now, this is not something that's invented by Louis XIV, obviously. It starts earlier on, but it reaches its culmination under his minister, Colbert. And mercantilism is a theory of economics, of economic policy, that says that the government is to supervise and guide and plan and design and monitor and subsidize and prohibit and nationalize and give out monopolies in every aspect of economic life. Prices, wages are to be set, tariffs. Quality of goods is to be determined by government inspectors. If it's decided that France needs a silk industry, well, it's going to be somebody's either going to be given a monopoly to produce silk, or the government itself will set up silk works. Colonies will be set up, will be gathered and set up as captive markets for the goods of France or whatever country is involved, and also they will be prohibited from selling their raw materials to anyone but France. In this way, the aim is to maximize the amount of gold and silver at the disposal of the state. And what's the purpose of that? Because the state is conceived of as an endless machine for war. And gold and silver are the best things to have if you're going to go to war. Anybody who has gold and silver can have soldiers and ships. We're not talking about national armies here. These are all mercenary armies, largely. And this is the ultimate end, then. This is the concept, this is the paradigm or model that they have. The state is there to expand, and with its expansion expands the glory of the ruler. Everybody is a member of the state, is born into this world to help the state expand and to achieve vicarious glory by belonging to a glorious state with a glorious ruler. And in his testament, Louis XIV sums up this philosophy by saying this is all natural since the King of France is the owner of France. He owns France and permits peasants or the merchants, whoever happens to have some property of some kind, to retain temporary usage of his property because it serves a good function, it helps production. But at any time when he should wish to call back his property, of course, it's perfectly within his right to do so. This is the doctrine, then, of royal absolutism. And it's summed up at this one moment, you might say, in the history of Europe. Now, the example, Louis XIV is simply the one who perfects it. It had been going on for a long time. And in other places as well, with France very often acting as the model. The attempt is made to introduce this system now into a country whose traditions really already are quite different from that of continental Europe. As a matter of fact, as Alan McFarlane has shown in his book on the origins of English individualism, already back in the Middle Ages, in the High Middle Ages, travelers who came to England recognized there was something different about this country. There was something different about this people, about its laws, about its character. And then the Stuart family comes down from Scotland and thinks that it's going to rule in England as their absolutist other absolutist princes are in other countries. And that's the history of England in the 17th century. That's, in a nutshell, the history of England in the 17th century. The titanic constitutional struggle between, on the one hand, the House of Stuart, and on the other hand, the forces of, let's call them very generally the popular forces. And out of the 17th century comes, you might say, the prehistory of classical liberalism. We already now begin to see the form of it. Already, by the middle of the 17th century in England, there are people whom Roy Childs and George Smith can look back on as comrades in arms, brothers. Already the philosophy of individual rights is going to be proclaimed in the most stirring terms. Well, I don't have to go into details. I'm sure that you all have some general idea of what happens. There's James I, who is allowed to rule for a while, but already things are getting a bit antsy. But when his son comes to the throne, there's one disaster after another. And in the case of ship's money, where he wants to impose by his own will, tax, traditional tax to maintain the fleet, but now on areas of England, cities inland that had never paid it before. And his supporters say, what are you worried about? It's what's a couple of pennies in the pound. Why do you make such a big deal about this? Just because he does it on his own and doesn't ask the consent of Parliament. Right? In the same way that you could say, because of the stamp tax and the tea tax, what was minuscule amounts? What are you getting so worried about? And the answer was that if we allow this principle, there will be nothing a man can call his own. If we allow this principle, then it means that his will and not the laws rule in England. Well, one thing went, led to another. The Civil War breaks out. And in the middle of the, and the king is executed, in the middle of the 17th century, you have a period, just a little more than 10 years, of where there is no king. It's called the Protectorate, or otherwise the Commonwealth, of extraordinary intensity of political thought. Because, and it's natural, right? They're in a totally unprecedented situation. They have to start thinking up, what are they going to do about this? Where are they going to find any new authority? What legitimates authority anyway? And you have the great period, the classical period of English political thought, with Hobbes and afterwards with Locke also. But you have the first writers that we could say, if we were making up an anthology of classical liberalism, for instance, it's in the middle of the 17th century that we would start putting in names. There's John Milton, for instance, the great poet, Milton, who wrote on freedom of the press against the government's... this is now the Stuarts are thrown out. This is now what's supposed to be the revolutionary government, the government that was supposed to come in to guarantee the rights of the people. And they say that nobody can have a printing press who does not get a license from the government beforehand. And that way, obviously, they want to control the press, and Milton argues against it. And there's a group that goes by the unfortunate name Levelers, because they were not socialists. There were the first socialists, as a matter of fact, who appeared at this time. They were called the Diggers. The Levelers believed in the radical notion that all individuals have equal rights, given by God. Equal rights to life, to liberty, and to property. In fact, so far from being socialist, they were radically against any kind of government intervention in the economy, especially the typical kind of government intervention in the economy on behalf of, I mean, when the government intervenes in the economy, the typically what happens? On whose behalf do they intervene, right? On behalf of their friends, the financiers, the capitalists, the ones who are close to the levers of power. Now, Levelers said, look at the people who are getting special monopoly grants from the government. Look at the people who are getting, look at these guilds in London, where only the certain handful of masters have the right to exercise a particular trade. What a person needs to exist, to make a living, to survive, his labor, he can't even sell freely. So what they were in favor of was an early version, as much as could have been, could have existed at the time, of what you could call a free market. They were also in favor of freedom of religion, which very few of the parties were, and some of them were even in favor of freedom of religion for Catholics, which was a very, very radical position at the time. So what we have with the levelers, if you look at their rhetoric, if you look at the social class they come from, they tend to come from skilled workers, small shopkeepers, printers, many printers involved, professional people. Then if you look at their rhetoric, their insistence on life, liberty, and property. Okay, and by property, they don't mean defending property, not just defending it against socialist masses or welfare savages or whatever, hordes of roaming welfare savages, as you know, the kind of right-wing fantasy. But very importantly, defending property against the people at the top of society who want to use the state, for instance, to set up a bank that will be allowed to issue non-redeemable paper, which will then become legal tender. Or those people at the top of society who want to set up a funded government debt, okay, which is going to exist forever, and which they will be living off the interest of, these capitalists at the top of society. Meanwhile, who's paying for this debt, for the servicing of this debt? Who's paid for it? Well, it's these people. It's a small businessman. It's a professional people. It's a working people. Now, this is the first time we've come across this class with this ideology in history, and it won't be the last. They will be the people throughout the 18th century that represent this point of view. This is the class that Tom Paine speaks for. This is the class that in the North, at least, helps to make the American Revolution. This is the class of the early English radicals, and this is the class that the Manchester liberals and Cobden and Bright will speak for also. So the levelers have this great importance. Of course, as I say, the constitutional history of England at this time is somewhat complicated. The Stuarts are brought back for a time. However, there's another problem. And finally, the Glorious Revolution occurs in 1688. And as part of this, the ideological expression of this revolution, although it had been formulated in the mind of the philosopher before that, is the philosophy of John Locke, especially as expressed in the Second Treatise of Government. Very familiar, I think, to all of us, the idea of the state of nature, natural rights, natural inalienable rights, the life, liberty, and property, and government coming in as a convenience to make up for the drawbacks of a state of nature. What does that imply? It implies that you and I didn't come into the world to serve the government, or to serve someone like Louis XIV, or to serve someone like James II. Government itself comes into the world to serve people, and specifically to better preserve their natural rights. You see, it's not us who serve the government, it's the government which is there for our rights. This becomes, in one way or another, the standard philosophy, the standard ideology of the English-speaking people. A lot of things have changed since then, but this idea never really has died out. Well, the battle between the Stuarts and the popular forces is decided in 1688. And then before William and Mary come to the throne, they are forced to agree to a Bill of Rights. Now, on behalf of themselves and their successors, in England, absolutism has lost. Clearly it is lost. Clearly something different has occurred here from the rest of the continent. And that's going to interest the other Europeans very much. The 18th century is a century of the Enlightenment. And one way of conceiving of the Enlightenment is in this way. What is the Enlightenment? The Enlightenment is the discovery of what has happened in England by French intellectuals who now decide to spread those ideas to France and through France to the rest of Europe. You see, the social and political reality is now different in England. And it happens that a class of intellectuals comes into existence, they're called the philosophes, or philosophers, who on the whole find it very interesting what's happened in England. They admire many things that they see in England, and wish that their own country could become more like that. These philosophers have famous names. There's Voltaire, for instance, or Montesquieu, Believe it or not, if you really put your mind to it, you could learn how to spell that. Montesquieu. There are other philosophers, because the Enlightenment is 70 or 80 years, three generations or so, of intellectual and cultural life. So it's a lot of different things. I don't want to give the idea that it's only one thing. And there are contrary currents to it. There are parts of the Enlightenment which really are very subversive of classical liberalism. There's Rousseau, for instance. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who has a tremendous influence in a basically anti-liberal direction. I try to avoid psycho-smears in presenting history, you know, attacking somebody on the basis of a screwed-up life, let's say. But I do make exceptions to that, two major exceptions, and which I think are perfectly justified. One is Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and the other, of course, is Woodrow Wilson. So, in the case of Rousseau, perhaps it's not enough to talk about his how screwed up his life was, but considering that he sat as a moral judge, the man, first of all, he's a total hypocrite. Alan Bloom, you see his from the University of Chicago, his new book on education is being talked about everywhere. It's a bestseller. Bloom wrote the introduction to a letter. It's the size of a book by Rousseau, called Letter to D'Alembert. D'Alembert was another of these philosophers. And in this letter, Rousseau, D'Alembert said Geneva, where Rousseau came from, is a real fine city, but it would really be improved if there were a theater there. And Rousseau, oh God, a theater in Geneva. Don't you understand how awful the stage is? Don't you understand how immoral actors and actresses are? Don't you understand how immoral it is even to be an actor? Pretending, lying, being a hypocrite. And you want to bring this to Geneva and corrupt the people? Well, and Alan Bloom thinks this is a really interesting argument here, because he wrote the introduction to this book of Rousseau. One problem with this is that both before and after, Rousseau wrote for the theater. You understand? He wrote operas and he wrote the musical productions for the stage. So it's very so typical of Rousseau. I mean, try to deal with this guy as a serious thinker. He talks himself into a moral outrage over something. Meanwhile, of course, you know, he does it every day of the week. people talk about as far as Rousseau goes that he's contradictory. Well, you know, maybe the time comes when you have an author who's contradictory that it's not worth trying to square his contradictions. Maybe he's not a very serious writer. One thing that Rousseau did was he wrote in a kind of semi-socialist vein. Some people consider him one of the fathers of socialism. In his essay on inequality, he says inequality came about when the first man fenced in a piece of land and called it his own and found people fool enough to believe him. That was the beginning of inequality, and all of the miseries that came to the human race came in with private property. And Voltaire, when he heard this, was outraged. Rousseau sent him a copy of his book, and he wrote back and said, "Oh, monsieur, I was very pleased to receive your book, Against the Human Race. And I have read it, and take to heart the recommendation that we all begin walking on all fours again. But since I have not done this in 60 years, I don't see how I can." And in private, Voltaire said, "This man is a maniac. Does he mean to say that a man who has cleared Voltaire, a total Lockean in this regard, a man who has cleared some property, made it arable, farmed, it has no right to it? This Rousseau is an enemy of civilization." Voltaire, more than anyone else, spread the ideas of Locke and of what was happening in England. If you want to read a nice little book, it's still in paperback. Voltaire is very readable. Philosophical Letters on the English that he writes in the 1720s. The English have religious toleration. He says, go to the London Stock Exchange, which is a more moral place to be than many a court. And there you will see how people who are Quakers and Catholics and Jews and Muslims and so on treat each other with tremendous respect. They get along in total peace. Nobody bothers about anybody's religion because they're there for business. Voltaire was a great admirer, as many of the philosophers were, of the business ethic. The business ethic is a peaceful ethic. It brings people together for mutual advantage in trade. It is the opposite of the ethic of religious persecution, which is the ethic of mindless fanaticism. Not for your own advantage, who gets any advantage out of it, but solely the will to fanaticism and to destruction. The business ethic is the constructive principle. With Montesquieu, of course, we have the idea of the checks and balances within the government. But as time goes short, and we're still in the 18th century, I want to mention another group in 18th century France. Also among the philosophers, they also contribute to the great philosophical work, the Encyclopedia, the Grand Encyclopedia, in many volumes. They're called the Physiocrats. Or some people call them the economists. They are indeed a school of economists. And they have particular economic ideas, which are not of very much interest now, but their principle of economic policy was highly influential. This world of mercantilism, this world of detailed supervision of every aspect of economic life by the government, this world that assumes that it's only the government that can keep the economy in motion, this world, they say, ought to be swept away. What should we put in its place? Well, their name already tells you. Their name already tells you. This is the rule of nature, as in physis, the Greek word for nature. Let nature rule. What does that mean? That means allow the self-interest of individuals to bring it about that all of the resources of society are allocated in the most profitable and rational way. Their slogan was the one that classical liberalism would put on its banner, the slogan of laissez-faire. Actually, the whole thing was laissez-faire, laissez-passer, le monde va de lui-même. Laissez-faire, let it be, let it pass. That means let goods pass. Le monde va de lui-même. The world goes by itself. The world goes by itself. It doesn't need constant direction by the state. And these ideas became quite fashionable for a while. A man who was influenced by them, who was close to the philosophes, became for a while a leader in France. His name was Turgot. I wish that I could tell you. See, these are not just names. You know, one gets the impression, if you hear them over and over, one after the other, they are simply names. I wish I could had time to tell you a little more what was behind these names. Turgot is one of the few non-rulers who is called the Great sometimes. It's called the Great Turgot. Generally, the Great is a term which is limited to mass murderers. Or to people like Catherine the Great, whose greatness consisted largely in placing under serfdom the peasantry of Russia. I mean, that you got to be proud of, ending a life looking back at that. Well, at least I made serfs out of the peasants of Russia. Turgot, on the other hand, devoted his life to, as best he knew, the lights he had, improving the condition of the people of France through the introduction of economic liberty. In the chapter that Murray Rothbard has on Turgot, in the to be published, The History of Economic Thought, Murray was, a great lover of chess when he was at Columbia. He was on the chess team. And he says in his chapter, at chess tournaments, there's a special prize that's given out for brilliance. That's not necessarily the one who wins the tournament, but the one whose particular game has that quality the chess experts call brilliance. Not the same as power necessarily, but that special kind of. And he said, if such a prize were given out in economics, it should go to Turgot with his little book on the formation and distribution of wealth. So he was a brilliant intellectual. Friend, by the way, let me try to give you this feeling, a friend of Benjamin Franklin. We're beginning to have now a transatlantic community. These are not isolated ideas anymore. When Franklin comes to Paris, Turgot is the one who makes up a little epigram in Latin in his honor, the English translation of which goes, "He plucked fire from heaven and the scepter from the tyrant's hand." They were great friends, as afterwards Lafayette and Jefferson were going to be great friends, as Tom Paine and Condorcet were great friends, as in the 19th century, Charles Sumner and Cobden and Bright were friends. We have, as I say, a transit, the communication, transportation is difficult to an extent, but more and more, there are people who see themselves as part of an international movement, and that's very important. And I give a good many I've given a good many lectures over the years at summer seminars, both here and at IHS and elsewhere. And I think that maybe at the end of these, especially since now more and more foreign students are beginning to come to them, you might be getting the same sense that this is not simply a movement that's limited to one nation. This is an international movement, because what we're talking about are universal values, and this is the idea that the liberals of the time began to have. Now, in 1774, a new king came to the throne of France, Louis XVI. He was 19 years old. Something had to be done. France was in terrible shape. It was a very backward country. He makes Turgot into his economics minister. Turgot says, "In my family, the men die young." And he begins issuing decrees, edicts. "Can only be done from the top down," he says. "We don't have time for democracy." He frees the grain trade, does away with internal tariffs in France, does away with the corvée. Corvée was the forced labor on peasants. That's how they built roads or docks or anything. It was forced labor they had to give up. Introduces toleration for Protestants. And in one way, in one decree after another, attempts to establish the laissez-faire system that he and the physiocrats and other philosophes believed in. For reasons that Manker Olson could have explained to him, because of the resistance of the entrenched interests, he fails. The Queen of France, who's also a young woman, an Austrian, thinks that he's disrupting too much. Her friends at court, the people who are, of course, he wants to cut down taxes. He says, there's no way you have to cut down these taxes. It's destroying the productive power of society. We can't keep borrowing all the time. You can't keep getting into war. He makes enemies all around. So the time comes when Louis XVI, not a very strong-willed individual under any circumstances, caves in. Turgot is dismissed in 1776. Some 17 years later, the king and queen will face the consequences. The last attempt, the last chance that they had, there existed for reformation, for a radical change in France short of the revolution. Then the revolution came. And with it, many, many other problems. So that this reform plan did not succeed. But Turgot has gone down in history as a man who had in a very sincere way, the good of an aristocrat, one of the oldest families in France, had the good of the people at heart. But now, at the end of the 18th century, many of these ideas are beginning to be translated into practical reality. George is going to be telling you something about the American Revolution, which found friends among the liberals of Europe, especially in France, of course, and Germany, scattered in other countries, but above all in England. Fox, even Burke, but Priestley, Price, supported the American colonists, toasted the defeat of the of English arms, because it was the principle and not transient national glory that was their concern. The American colonists, the Declaration of Independence, the principles and values they were fighting for, that was their cause. And especially if George III should succeed in subduing these colonists, then England's turn would come next. So that American Revolution was itself a battle for English liberties in the mind of the English liberals. Now, in the last years of the century, with the Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen, written by Lafayette with help of from Jefferson and other French liberals, the ideas become broadcast to the whole world. This idea of individual rights, this idea of natural rights, now becomes dynamite. Dynamite exploding ancient empires and the whole old order. A lot of things happen. The French Revolution goes awry. By the way, one of our friends, this is an international movement, and especially Leonard Liggio has very strong contacts with the French New Liberals. One of them is a professor of economic history at the Sorbonne, Professor Aftalion, Florent Aftalion, who's just written a book on one of the major reasons, if not the major reason, why the French Revolution went wrong. Something which most other historians have tended to neglect, and that was the runaway inflation. That was the Assignat inflation, which destroyed the French economy, led to, and then with price controls, led to shortages, brought a hunger-crazed mob onto the scene of Parisian politics and French politics. In its own way, probably more than anything else, led to the Reign of Terror. Well, many things happen that we don't have any time to go into. One thing that happens is that a general of genius now takes over, and through force of French arms, and through the success of French arms, values and institutions which the liberals believed in are now spread by force. As the French army takes over more and more territory, in Spain they abolish the Inquisition, for instance. When they take over the Rhineland, they abolish the guild system. One of the things the Constituent Assembly determines, and this is part of the Code Napoleon, everybody has equal access to every profession, with the exception of the doctors and a couple of other professions that they're able to slip a monopoly power in for. But there are no more of the old guild restrictions or the necessity to acquire a special patent in order to pursue a profession. Essentially, there is freedom. There's freedom of trade and occupational freedom. That old system, industrial system, is now at an end in France and in the countries that the French armies take over. also, religious toleration is introduced. For instance, the emancipation of the Jews that I told you about the beginning. I started with talking about the second-class citizen status of the Jews. Well, that's rectified under the new Code Napoleon and under the new French Revolutionary dispensation. Nobody is discriminated against in law because of religion. So, ironically, many of these liberal reforms do spread because they are implemented by war, by actual arms. The French actually annex large chunks of other countries, like all of Holland, for instance, and the Western Germany and so on. And naturally, French law applies there because it's now part of France. But in the satellite kingdoms, they set up the same sort of thing. Unfortunately, one consequence of this, then, is that in many countries, liberal ideas are now associated with the victorious French and with the humiliation of their own countries, especially in Germany, and most significantly in Germany. Liberalism is something which is considered foreign, and it is associated, it is combined in the minds of people with the worst days of national humiliation. So reaction against liberalism starts in many places that's going to have very bad consequences for the future. But when the dust settles in the 1820s, let's say, after the peace conference, after 1815, in the 1820s, 1830s, liberalism is a crusading movement. It is the true specter that's haunting Europe. Karl Marx tries to maintain that it's communism in 1848, but outside of Paris, that's simply not true. It's wishful thinking. It's liberalism that is frightening the ruling powers. And the liberal program, allowing for some national modifications, is essentially a universal program. It's the same basic set of demands in Western Europe, in Central Europe, in North America. The liberals demand the abolition of slavery and serfdom, total freedom of contract, a free labor market, the emancipation of the rural population, the right of anyone to move anywhere in the country to settle and practice any trade that he can find customers for, a kind of freedom of labor that had never existed since the fall of the Roman Empire in Europe. And freedom also for property. No encumbrances, special encumbrances on one form of property as against another, especially as regards the land. Everything now to fall under the total freedom of contract of the property owner. There's also the demand for a constitution where it does not exist in written or unwritten form, limitations on the state power, and especially limitations on the police power. And together with this, a declaration of some kind that would list and acknowledge the rights enjoyed by the individual. The right to religion and the press and assembly and the other rights that the Americans had shown the way for in their state Declaration of Rights, Bill of Rights, which everybody in all the liberals in Europe knew about, the Virginia Bill of Rights especially, and in their National Bill of Rights, America being a model to the Europeans in this regard. And then finally, economic freedom, now political freedom, and to assure this, the liberals demanded peace, an end to the state as an expanding war machine, an end to that model. Peace, peace among peoples, to be consolidated by free trade. Everybody will now become everybody else's customers, and liberals say it is not a usual phenomenon to see a storekeeper shooting at his customers. Even today, in this crazy society we have today, it's not the usual thing for the guy in the Safeway to sit up there behind some kind of cage or something, shooting, sniping at the customers as they go by. As long as freedom of trade is allowed, the peoples will come closer and closer to each other. An end to imperialism. Colonies are cost more, always cost more than they're worth, except to the few, just a very few insider-type capitalists who benefit from them, but for the great majority of people. Through taxes for administration and the upkeep of armies, colonies cost much more than they're worth. So free the colonies, end imperialism, and associate with other countries on the basis of total freedom of trade. This will usher in a period of peace. Peace is for the is what the people want and need, even if the aristocrats and others who benefit from war don't. So this is then the liberal program. It's under the auspices of this program that the liberals then, in the course of the 19th century, go on very often to victories, sometimes to defeat, then as the century goes on, more and more to defeat. But in the course of time, what they've done, as I'll try to outline in my next lecture, is meet cope with, accommodate an enormous problem that Europe is faced with. And that is a population explosion of the late 18th century and early 19th century. The creation of millions and millions of new human beings who simply have no place in the old economic order. And it's liberalism's main function, historically, to tear down the old obsolete mercantilist guild order, to create a free labor market and a system of based on private property, and in that way to have permitted these millions of people to survive. Meanwhile, changing the world and changing mentalities so that when I read to you at the beginning of this lecture that list of things which historical occurrences which seem so strange, so alien to us, it was hard for us even to picture, to be able to imagine a world like that. So different has liberalism changed everything, not least of which our own minds. Okay, thank you. And thank you.